It's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
Hey guys, man, I'm excited. It's Monday. I know, it's weird to be excited about Mondays, but you know what? If you're excited about your business, as I know most of you guys, doesn't it just make sense to be excited about Mondays? We should be as excited about Mondays as we are as excited about Fridays. You know, I remember when I first started working for myself, my first business, I used to hate weekends and holidays, you know, because I couldn't work on my business. There wasn't anybody to do business with. Anyway, later on, I've gotten a little bit more balance in my life, so I enjoy my weekends now probably as much as I enjoy my work week, maybe even more because I'm a little bit more settled and I'm not as impatient. Does that make sense? And so I like a 3-day weekend. I'm a big proponent of having a 4-day work week. I think everybody should bust their butts, and we probably already do anyway. We're already probably working 10, 12-hour days anyway. Most of us are. Why not just take Friday, Saturday, and Sunday off? It just makes sense, doesn't it? It makes good sense. Hey, speaking of making sense, my first guest, Mary King. Mary King is a IRS attorney, and she solves problems for you and me and people like you and me. She is the person that we go to when we're having challenges with those pesky people there at the IRS. Mary King is, like I said, an IRS problem-solving attorney and co-author of the best-selling book, Protect and Defend. Mary's career as an attorney began in 1993 after graduating from Stetson University College of Law. Her career in law was primarily focused on IRS problem-solving as well as mortgage foreclosure defense. Mary has been practicing law for over 19 years and enjoys helping her clients removing the dark cloud of the IRS. Mary King, welcome back to Money for Lunch.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I know. Isn't it exciting to hear on Monday?
It is, especially on Columbus Day.
On Columbus Day, that's right. Well, you know what? I'm excited to have you on the show simply because as we continue our historic government shutdown, I think that we are now in historic times here. I don't think a shutdown has ever gone this long. I could be wrong. I can't remember. I know the last one that we had was when Clinton was in office, but I think that one only lasted like 2 or 3 days. Here we are. We're definitely in a record situation. We're going on what? I can't remember. Is this day 12 or 15 or something? Anyway, let me ask you this, because people I know are just would love to know, how is the IRS affected during this government shutdown?
Well, that's a great question. And right now, the IRS has temporarily suspended sending out tax refunds. The tax court has suspended operations. And if you need to call the IRS for any reason, the service centers are shut down. The local IRS offices are shut down. So really, at this point, the only thing that is operating or that needs to be done is tomorrow is the deadline for people who filed extensions. And so if you did file an extension, those tax returns are still due tomorrow.
I love it. I love it, right? Like any good business, hey, everything is shut down but your ability to pay us, right?
That's right. So if you owe money or if you filed an extension, that tax return is still due tomorrow.
And so if you owe money, I want to expand on this a little bit. Your payments are still due if you're on a payment plan, or like you said, if you're filing your taxes tomorrow, you should send in the full amount that you owe, correct?
That's correct. So if you're, like you said, if you're making installment agreement payments or if you're making estimated tax payments, of course, payroll tax deposits, all those things, you still have to continue making those payments.
Absolutely. I love it. All right. Well, it's good to know that, you know, the IRS is still accepting our money. That's you know, that's kind of reassuring. Unfortunately, it looks like most of their services are shut down. Let's talk about this. You mentioned the tax court and those cases that are shut down. How would that affect the tax court cases?
Well, if for instance, you did have a tax court case that was ongoing, or if you needed to file a tax court case, or if you need to file a pleading or a paper in the tax court case, unfortunately, the tax court did suspend its operations beginning October 1st. So if you had a trial or if anything was supposed to happen in your tax court case, the case has now been suspended, and it will be suspended through the period of the government shutdown. So no documents will be received by the court, or any e-filings or anything else, and the court will not serve any documents on you either. So essentially, the government shutdown has suspended any tax court case until after the government shutdown is over.
Gotcha. All right, well, let's talk about this, because I know that even though it seems like it's kind of a long time away, it really isn't. Seems like tax year seems to catch us all by surprise every year, and I don't understand why, because it happens every year, if I'm not mistaken, right around April 15th, doesn't it?
The same time every year.
And that's right, the same time every year. And you know what? Something that I kind of put together, I kind of discovered or learned, I don't know what the right phraseology is, but, you know, that President Lincoln died, was shot on the 14th, but he died on the 15th of April. So I don't know what that means, but maybe that'll help people remember. Oh, yeah, you know, Lincoln died also. Anyway, I do want to talk about this, because I think that and my point when I started down this little rabbit hole was I want to talk about unregulated tax preparers. What can happen as a result of using these unregulated tax preparers, these people that maybe do it as a hobby, do it part-time, working from home? What are some of the results that can happen from using these type of preparers?
Well, unfortunately, the things that can happen is they are not as well versed on the tax code as using someone who is actually an enrolled agent or a CPA, and they may not be, you know, like I said, as well versed on the tax code and tax rules and regulations. And the IRS has made some steps to get more strict on tax preparer penalties for using these kind of people who are not up on the rules. And in a recent government report, the IRS is improving its procedure for enforcing penalties on unregulated tax preparers. So if they make mistakes on your return, there could be higher penalties imposed for people who prepare your returns that aren't regulated, such as the regulated preparers, such as enrolled agents and CPAs.
Gotcha. And also, you know, something that I want to, that I kind of think about, you know, is that, for instance, I can do my own breaks if I, you know, whatever, but I choose not to. I'd rather go to somebody who's a professional who can warranty their work, right? So if they install them incorrectly, I can go back to them and they can redo it, and they have the financial resources to warranty their work. Well, liken that to a unregulated tax preparer? What I'm concerned about is if by chance either they screwed up or I screwed up, can they help me with the IRS? Can they help me navigate to use your vernacular, the dark cloud of the IRS? Because let me tell you, if they screw up and all of a sudden, you know, last thing I want to hear is, well, you know, tax season is over. I'm just doing my regular job now. I can't help you. Now I got to go find somebody else to help me. And guess what? It's going to cost me more money because they have to sit there and go through my filing that they're unfamiliar with to see where this unregulated tax preparer screwed up, right?
Well, and that's correct, because somebody who's not regulated through the IRS cannot represent you in an audit or in tax court or anywhere else. If you have somebody that's just preparing returns on the side, maybe out of their house or something, they cannot go in front of the IRS, you know, such as a tax attorney or an enrolled agent or a CPA, and represent you if there is a problem with your return or in the event, like I said, that you get audited.
Right. Yeah, and that, you know, maybe it doesn't happen but very often, but at the last, you know, bottom line is it's something that, you know, you want to make sure that you're dealing with somebody that can certainly help you. Let's talk about this real quick, because I found this to be very interesting. There is a gentleman who is the creator of the Beanie Baby craze, and recently he pleaded guilty to tax evasion. Walk me through this. What happened?
Well, you may have heard about this, but the IRS is getting stricter on people who have money overseas. They've called it the offshore disclosure. And for people who do have money in bank accounts overseas, and it can be anywhere, it can be Swiss bank accounts or Canadian bank accounts or, you know, money in the Caribbean, the IRS wants people to disclose this. And apparently this gentleman had money in a Swiss bank account, which he did not disclose. And so the IRS found out about it. And after he did not disclose this money, they did prosecute him for it. And the IRS has a program, it's called the Offshore Disclosure Program, where you can, if you do have money overseas and you haven't disclosed it, you can come forward and disclose that money. And so, you know, he didn't do that, and that's what the problem is. He got prosecuted for that.
Wow. And so for you guys who have not checked out this story, just type in, you can just type in Beanie Baby Creator. You'll see it's all over the internet there. The gentleman is, what's his name, Ty Warner, H. Ty
right.
Warner, 69. Yeah, he ended, you know, he pleaded guilty and will pay $25 million, let's see, $25 million because he evaded $5 million in taxes. You know, you know what, and this is so typical of human nature. It's not just people like Ty Warner, but we all do this, and we have to be aware of how frail we are. Here's a guy who's a billionaire who could probably pull out, you know, money out of his pocket and pay $5 million in taxes, but isn't it just sometimes our own stupid nature that gets us into trouble? Here's a guy who's a billionaire, and easily could have paid his $5 million in taxes, chose to evade, got spanked, and now he's paying $25 million in penalties and taxes and all that other stuff. But it looks like he's not going to do any jail time, isn't it? Let's see.
Right. He shouldn't do any jail time. But the point is, if people who have money in these offshore accounts should come forward through the offshore voluntary disclosure program, because you can, you know, if you don't voluntarily disclose, you know, you can be subjected to criminal penalties.
Right. You're right, and you're right. That is the point, that you need to come forward, because there's so much misinformation out there, and you want to be aware of it. First of all, you have to disclose all of your income, period, right? As long as you live here, no matter where you make your money, you have to pay taxes, right?
Absolutely.
It used to be that, you know, at one point, and again, you correct me, because this is the area that I'm not clear on, I believe at one point, if you had money and you made money overseas, that you didn't have to pay taxes on that, but that has changed, right?
There's a certain amount that you can exclude if you're living overseas for a certain length of time. You can't exclude a certain amount of that income.
Gotcha. But you have to, again, qualify under those guidelines to see what you can and cannot exclude. to be safe, either get some talk to somebody like Mary King who can help you with these questions, or just pay your taxes and, you know, err on the side of caution, right?
Right, right. But definitely look into the guidelines to see if you qualify.
Absolutely. And if you have questions, you can check out people. Again, you know, go to your tax preparer. You can go to somebody like Mary King. You can check her out at kinglawpl.com, kinglawpl.com, or might be easier to just remember taxlawyerflorida.com, taxlawyerflorida.com. She can help you no matter what state you're in, because taxes, the IRS stuff, can be handled from anywhere, right?
Yes, they can.
All right, Mary, we're out of time. Thank you so much for stopping by. Great information. And again, as always, I appreciate you stopping by and sharing.
Thank you very much. It was great being here.
All righty. We'll talk to you later. Guys, we're off and running. Great stuff there by Mary King regarding our taxes. Remember, tax season is actually just a few months away, even though I know it seems like a long time. My next guest, Deb Cheslow, when we come back from this commercial break.
Did you bring the camera phone?
I did.
Do you want to go first?
I've been waiting for this all day.
Okay, this is Bro
and Stacy.
Introducing Chase Quick Deposit. Just photograph the front and back of your check using the Chase mobile app on your iPhone and hit send.
It went through?
So cool.
It's just so cool.
You want to try it?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, it was nice.
Make a deposit from anywhere, anytime with your iPhone.
To Mr. and Mrs. Walker, why would they send my parents a check?
Chase what matters.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Caller Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Then let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
Hey, guys, we are back. My next guest, Deb Cheslow, is an America's Achievement Expert. She's an award-winning number one international best-selling author, speaker, corporate trainer, consultant, and facilitator who has spent her entire life defying the odds to achieve goals that should not have been possible. She teaches a process for looking fear in the face and then acting in spite of that fear using a system she learned as an instructor pilot in the United States Air Force, teaching airmen to fly advanced supersonic jets, a system that is easily duplicatable by individuals, teams, organizations, and companies to create phenomenal results. I'm excited to have Deb Cheslow joining us today on Money for Lunch. Deb, welcome.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
I'm excited. I love this book, and I love this picture of you right here with the jet and stuff. And so I'm excited to get your insights, because really, you people really do stare fear in the face on a regular basis, right?
Oh, they sure do. I mean, the fear of change is what it all comes down to. If people want to grow and have more and do more and be more, but change scares them into stopping every single time.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk about this. When people ask you, what do? You often say that I turn shoulds into dids. Walk me through this. What do you mean?
Well, you think about it. Where would you be if every time you said, I should, you actually did whatever it was you're referring to? See, so many people most people are not very good at keeping commitments, period, because we're in such a busy world, so overloaded, overstressed, overworked, that we promise more than we can deliver. But even those that are pretty good at keeping commitments to others are usually pretty poor at keeping commitments to themselves. So if you were able to do that, if you were able to form a habit of keeping commitments, of doing everything you said you wanted to do or should do, where could you take your life?
Yeah, I love that. You know, right there is a new, what do you call it, pattern that we need to interrupt, or not a new pattern, an old pattern that we need to interrupt. I should lose weight. I should do this. I should organize my garage, or I should get rid of the clutter in my garage. But then we don't. And sometimes it is because we're busy. I agree with you. And sometimes it's because, lazy. Maybe our goals aren't very motivating. What do you think?
I think it's a combination of all that, actually. Most people don't understand there's an actual science behind goal setting and goal achieving, and most people tend to go for what they think they can get or what somebody else thinks they should go after, when really a goal needs to be big and huge and scary. It needs to scare you to death and motivate you and inspire you, because if it doesn't, then why else would you put up with all the trouble it's going to cause you to achieve it? You know, so that's
right,
part of
right.
it. And then the other part is that, being busy, like you said, and then the fact that people are afraid of change, going back to what we said in the very beginning.
Right, absolutely. And what's so interesting about our fear of change is that we cannot avoid it. I mean, if you did nothing but if you tried your hardest trying to keep the same exact routine year after year, change will be imposed upon you anyway. They may do something as simple as maybe changing the freeway exits when they reconstruct some of the freeways in your town. So change will be imposed upon you. Your job may ask you to change something about the way you do business or do your job. You're getting older, so your body's changing. I mean, change is really our constant companion. But let me ask you this, Deb. Why do we fear change so much when it's all around us?
Well, in my opinion, the reason we fear change is because of logic. We are taught since day one to weigh the pros and the cons, to take a baby step, play it safe, don't take a risk, protect yourself. And really, what people don't understand is that logic is the key to failure, because logic is an accumulation of your past experience and your present knowledge. So it's everything you've done and everything you know. So how on earth could you use that to do something you've never done before? You can't. It's like taking tennis lessons to try to play the piano. You know, you're trying to use one thing that doesn't relate to another thing to accomplish it. It just won't work. And so what your logic does, as soon as you step out of your comfort zone and start trying to change, or change gets thrust upon you unexpectedly, like you said, that happens all the time, your logic can't explain it, so it sends up feelings of fear, which is basically a fear of the unknown. And most people don't have the courage to face that fear because they don't understand where it's coming from.
I love that. So logic is the key to failure. I love
exactly.
that.
That's,
and you know what? And that makes, you know, once I listen to you, that makes so much sense, because you're right. Logically speaking, what are we going to do? We're going to go to our past. Because that's where our experience and our knowledge is based on. And, you know, sometimes our past isn't what we should be looking at. We should just kind of go forward, right, is what you're saying?
Right. I mean, what I like to tell people is you only get one life. Today is the first day of the rest of your life. It's like you're born right now, right here in this moment.
Right.
You can't change the past. You can learn from it, but you can't change it. So if you spend all of your time dwelling on what you don't have, complaining about what you're stuck with, blaming other people, justifying why you should be happy with what you have or why it's somebody else's fault, then that's all you're thinking about. That's all you're going to get, because your logic, your past, and your present can explain all that. If you want to grow and have something you've never had, or do or be something you've never been, then you have to step outside your comfort zone and face that fear and take big action that's going to lead to big results. And that's uncomfortable.
Okay, so walk me through here. Okay, so if I'm not going to use logic or I'm not going to use my past experiences, start me what your strategy is to get somebody to move forward. If I was one of your clients, what would you know? And I came to you, I said, listen, I have this challenge, or I'm going to take on this new goal. It scares me to death. What would be your advice?
Okay, well, there is a 4-part system that we have people put into play. I'll give you the gist of it. Can't get into too much detail on such a short call, but then I'll give you an example. Okay. Standards, discipline, accountability, and systems. That's a 4-pillar system that I was taught in the Air Force when I was teaching people to fly advanced supersonic jets. I perfected it in the business world, used it in my life. The Air Force has used it to create phenomenal results, and people and teams can duplicate it, as you said in the intro. So what you do is you have to set the standard. You have to have that goal, that vision, that dream that excites you, motivates you, inspires you, makes you want to jump out of bed in the morning. That's what most people don't have. But then you have to realize that wishful thinking will get you nowhere. So, like the movie The Secret, got all kinds of hype, and it provides some really valuable information, but it stopped short. It didn't tell the whole story. Just the thinking part isn't enough. The second pillar is discipline. You have to have the discipline to take action every single day, no matter what, towards that goal. Well, then you've got wishful thinking, you've got a standard, you've got something you're dreaming about that's illogical, a fantasy, it's unrealistic. You've got the discipline to take action every day, but neither of those is going to be enough because your habits, your logic are going to get in the way. So if you don't have someone holding you accountable, that's the third pillar is accountability, to keep you going when the going gets tough, then you're doomed, right? So you need coaches, mentors, consultants, leaders, someone holding you accountable. But then on top of that, you need the fourth pillar, systems. Systems are the thing that keep you going when the going gets tough, when that coach or that leader or that accountability partner can't be there with you because, of course, they're not going to be there every minute of every day. So standards, discipline, accountability, and systems.
You know what, and I love these. I love these ideas: standards, discipline, accountability, and systems, because really, that's how you build something like as big as the pyramids. I mean, think about it. If you and I were to say, hey, we're going to build these pyramids, and we're going to use hand tools, and we're going to build them out of these monster granite rocks, you know, we would be laughed. We would be laughed out of our prospective cities, right? But these people did that because, and yes, they were slaves, and I understand that. But putting that aside, you see all four of these pillars in there. You have the standards. There was a specific standard that things had to be cut to a specific amount. Standard that these rocks had to be cut. They were all disciplined. Again, yes, they were disciplined, maybe against their will, but yet disciplined and accountable. And there was a system. There was a system for cutting the rocks, getting them down the Nile, and getting them up, getting them set in the right place. And so whether your goal is, let's say, as monstrous as the pyramids or maybe smaller, maybe it's you just want to lose some weight, maybe you want to save money, maybe you want to get a new career, I love this because it's standards, discipline, accountability, and systems. These four pillars can get you anything you want. Am I right?
Absolutely. And the diet example is a perfect one. I mean, think about, there's probably not a listener on the call that hasn't done a diet or multiple diets or know somebody that hasn't.
Right.
Hasn't. So somebody decides to go on a diet, and they get all excited, hyped up. This is the one. This one's finally going to work. So they go buy a diet book, sign up with a buddy, join an exercise program. And for that first week, they're all excited, and they eat 6 small meals, skip the snacks, drink plenty of water, actually get up and go to the gym 3 days that week, get to the end of the week, step up on the scale, and they lost 3 pounds. It's like, wow,
right.
It works. I proved it. But then what happens? You feel like celebrating. you feel like having a drink with the guys or having a piece of chocolate cake. Or Monday morning rolls around and you feel like sleeping in, right? See, and then life goes on. The emotional hype of the new diet fades. Habits kick in. Logic kicks in. You're back to the drudgery of daily ops. And you forget the emotion, and you revert back to your old habits, and suddenly you feel like having a cheeseburger, and you feel like sleeping in, and you're right back where you started, and then you say, oh, this diet doesn't work, and you go buy a new one. What you have to realize is you didn't lose the 3 pounds because you suddenly found the miraculous answer to dieting. Every adult out there knows how to lose weight. You lost the 3 pounds because you were excited, inspired, motivated, emotionally hyped up. But it's short term. You had discipline for a week and you had a standard, but now it's gone. So that's when you bring in an accountability partner, joining a program that has you weighing in or whatever. You put systems in place like, I've got to drink a gallon of water a day. Okay, I'm going to fill up this gallon jug full of water and I can't go to bed till this jug is empty, instead of trusting yourself to remember to drink water. Things of that sort.
Right. Right. That's right. You might even, you know, set aside a day like Sunday to maybe pre-cut or pre-cook all your meals, part of that system. You know what? And it's amazing to me what systems can do for people, both in, you know, at home as well as at work or in their career. You know, Deb, we're out of time, but I'd love to bring you back and talk more about your four pillars, about overcoming fear, and just come back and have you talk some more.
I'd love to. And meanwhile, if you want more information, anyone listening, if you go to the website, either debcheslow.com, or I know that's kind of hard, you can go to remarkablecourage.com. Either place, there's a place where you can sign up for 5 free videos that really go into detail on this and share the whole system with you. It's absolutely complimentary, no strings attached, just enjoy the videos.
I love it. I love it. So remarkablecourage.com. I think that's fairly easy to remember. Deb Cheslow, and that's CHESLOW.com. DebCheslow.com or remarkablecourage.com. Go out there, check out the free videos, dig a little bit deeper into these four pillars and put them to the test. See if it helps you overcome your fears and help you achieve some of your goals. Deb, thank you so much for stopping by and sharing.
Well, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it. Have a great day.
You bet. All righty. Guys, we're off and running. Great stuff there. I mean, really excitable, usable stuff there by Deb Cheslow. Check her out at debcheslow.com or remarkablecourage.com. I'm going to be talking about these four pillars probably all of this, the rest of this year, because they make sense. Standards, discipline, accountable, and systems. We're going to take a quick commercial break. And when we turn, Matt Cohen, right after this.
Well, I'm not sure what it is. I guess I'll be okay.
I'm calling the studio, Matthew. You're not shooting today.
Just get some rest.
He bought it.
Hi, can I get my CRV brought up, please?
Roderick. Roderick.
Life is packed with things you have to do.
But sometimes you gotta live a little.
Matthew, you poor thing.
Awful. How could I resist?
Look, I don't know what to tell you. He's sick. Actors get sick sometimes.
Thanks.
Have a good night.
Life moves pretty fast. If you don't stop and look around once in a while, you could miss it.
Get going in the all-new CR-V from Honda.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler, Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
Hey, guys, we are back. My next guest, Matt Cohen. Matt Cohen is a school and education attorney. Not sure what that is, but he's about to tell us. Maybe what he does is if you're just too stupid to learn, he sues you. No, I'm just kidding. Matt Cohen is an attorney with over 30 years of experience representing families of children and disabilities in dispute with public schools. Aha, now we know what it means. As well as dealing with problems of children and adults with disabilities in obtaining appropriate accommodations and services. He is active on the boards of several national and local disability rights organizations, speaks frequently on these topics around the country, and is the author of A Guide to Special Education Advocacy, What Parents, Advocates, and Clinicians Need to Know. His website is mattcohenassociates.com. Welcome, Matt Cohen.
Hi, how are you?
Great. I'm excited to have you on the show.
Happy to be here.
All right, well, let's talk about this. What are some of the concerns that you have with services to children with disabilities around the country under the current special education laws? What do you see going on?
Well, what's happening, it's a very sad time in terms of services for kids with disabilities because the Congress about 30 years ago recognized that kids with disabilities were not receiving appropriate services and were frequently not receiving services at all. And so there's been a lot of work done over the last 30 years to try to both ensure that kids with disabilities were able to participate in regular schools and to receive the services that they needed to be more independent and functional and to be as independent as possible when they reached adulthood. And the last roughly 9 years have seen a real erosion in some of the protections that kids with disabilities have in relation to what public schools are required to do, leading to fewer kids with disabilities being recognized as having a right to receive services, and the quality and extent of those services when they are eligible being reduced as well. And now with the federal and state budget crises, there is also a dramatic cost crunch occurring in public schools, and unfortunately, in many instances, the effect of that is disproportionately felt for children with disabilities. So the trend to cut back on services and protections that had already started is becoming even more serious by virtue of the funding crisis and the need for schools to reduce staff and to reduce programs. So the special ed budgets are one of the places that schools tend to look first in relation to finding ways to obtain savings. The result is that even more kids are not getting services that they need. What's troubling about that is it makes for a much more difficult educational experience and less productive educational experience for the kids with disabilities. It also means that many young people who could potentially be useful and productive members of society in adulthood are not getting as much help as they need and may be less likely to be able to work, to go to college, to have a job, to live on their own and so on, and more likely to need additional government support when they're adults. So it's kind of a paradox in which as we cut back on services and supports and finances, we're actually generating additional needs and problems that will face everyone in the years to come.
Yeah. You know what? And that is so typical of that short-sighted thinking, right?
We got to
save some money now, so we'll cut this program. But of course, we pay for it over and over again, and for a much longer degree as these kids turn into adults and graduate. And you know, I know that for most of our listening audience, a small percentage of our listening audience can relate to this. You know, they probably have kids who have special needs. I specifically know about these programs because my wife has worked in this environment, and she knows, and I have seen firsthand, we both have, how the cutbacks affect these kids, and it's
sure.
It's ridiculous. You know, I mean, you're looking at adults who are dealing with special needs children, and some of these special needs children are in high school, I think until the age of 19 or 20. They're in there for an extended period of time, and these teachers have to have special training, and they only get paid like, you know, $9-10 an hour. They don't get paid enough money to live on.
Yeah. Well, I think that it's a problem all over the country, and actually you mentioned that not that many people may be affected by it, but in reality, roughly 12-14% of the school-age population is currently eligible for special education, and there are a number of kids who are not identified or who've been refused identification beyond that or get other types of services based on disability. So it's actually, my guess would be that a very substantial number of people listening either have a child with a disability in their own family, or if not, either have it within the broader family or know a family that does, because, as I say, it's almost certainly over 10% of the population has a child with a disability themselves.
Yeah.
The effect of all of this for teachers, it's really kind of a sad thing, because it's sort of a setup for the kids and the families and the teachers as well, because the frontline staff people are working very hard to try to do the job, but they're not given the resources or training that they need. And as a consequence, they're put into very difficult situations with kids who are in need of help, but very eager to be at school and eager to learn, but with inadequate support, the teachers aren't really able to do all the things the kids need, and often it ends up being a frustrating and sometimes a difficult experience for both the child and the teacher. You mentioned something about when the kids, how long they qualify for services, and under the federal law, it can vary somewhat by state, but generally kids are eligible for services if they need them, not just through the end of senior year, but up through 21.
That's what it was. I know it's an extended period.
It varies a bit by state, but there's also one of the things in the law that's very important that sadly is among the places where there isn't enough support or resources provided, is when kids are 16 or older, they're supposed to receive what's called transition planning through the school system and transition services that are geared to be sure that they have the life skills to be able to do the things that they may be capable of if they're adequately prepared for whatever it is that they're going to do after graduation. And that's a gigantic area of opportunity, in that you can address academic skills for college, vocational skills for work, and life skills for people with disabilities being able to live independently or more independently if you give them the appropriate support. But again, that's a place where, because of insufficient funding, training, and motivation and commitment from schools and even from at the state level, many kids do not get as much support as they need in order to be able to graduate with meaningful skills, and they end up really having, in a sense, spent some of their time in school as a holding action rather than as something that really helped them to be independent.
Sure. Hey, let me ask you this real quick. With your experience, what have you had to deal with as far as disability rights and the maintenance of protections for persons with disability? What kind of stuff do you deal with there at your law firm?
Well, we deal with a wide variety of things. In addition to the problems that kids have with public education, they oftentimes are also experiencing problems in getting insurance benefits, getting public benefits from the state. They may be excluded from private programs like preschool or child care. And with young adults with disabilities, the frequent problem they have is first in obtaining accommodations from their colleges if they're going to college, and obtaining accommodations on tests like the ACT, SAT, the graduate admission exams, and sometimes even people will go to get a degree in law, medicine, dentistry, whatever it is, across the range of professions, and then they're refused accommodations on the licensing exams. And so they've gotten all of the educational work done to be a professional, and then They don't pass the licensing exam because they're not given appropriate accommodation for that, which is a terrible loss when you have someone who's put in the time and effort and been successful in getting through school and then can't pass the licensing exam because of those problems. I also deal with many problems with adults with more severe disabilities where they may be facing a situation where their needs are such that their family can't really support them within the home, or the family is the parents are getting older and they need to be in some alternative living situation. And in various states, unfortunately, some are far better and some are far worse, but in many situations, the individual ends up in a nursing home or a more institutional setting when they have the ability to be served in more natural community-based types of situations. So we do work in helping families to obtain appropriate services and funding so an adult with the more severe disabilities can live more independently. We also do work with obtaining accommodations for people with disabilities in the workplace. That's a very tricky issue because many people are afraid that if they disclose that they have a disability on the job, that they may be subject to discrimination. And in fact, that sometimes does happen. But on the other hand, they're in a catch-22 because if they don't disclose they have a disability, then they're not entitled to the same protections that you would have if the disability is disclosed and you've made a formal request to the employer to make accommodations. So there are oftentimes people who get caught in a bad situation and they're having difficulty on the job, but they're scared to share the fact that they have a disability. But by the time they're finally sharing it, they're already in sufficient trouble in terms of the ability to keep the job that it may be difficult to obtain the protections that they would have if they acted earlier. So that's a very tough thing for people to sort out, is to when it is that they decide to talk about whether they have a disability and need some sort of special accommodation. Employers are not
allowed. Matt, I got to cut you off. We're out of time, you're stopping by and sharing. Really appreciate that the work that you guys are doing there at MattCohenAndAssociates.com. Guys, if you have questions about your disability rights, check out MattCohenAndAssociates.com. Matt Cohen, thank you so much for stopping by and sharing.
Thanks a lot. Take care.
You bet. Bye-bye. Guys, we're off and running. Great stuff there about you and your rights. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and when we return, my friend John Kramer back with us talking about how to sell, promote, and use the books to make a living right after this.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler, Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on Geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
Hey, guys, we are back. Joining me is John Kramer. John Kramer is probably responsible for helping more people sell more books than anybody else. He's helped people like Jack Canfield and his partner Mark Victor Hansen. He's helped countless of other best-selling authors. He's also the best-selling author of 1,001 Ways to Market Your Books. He's an expert on book publishing and marketing. Besides being the owner of a publishing company, Open Horizons, in Tahoe, New Mexico, he's the editor of the Marketing Tip of the Week newsletter. John Kramer, welcome back to Money for Lunch.
Hi, Bert. How are you doing?
Man, I'm doing great. I'm excited to have you here on such a beautiful Monday.
Is it nice where you are?
Absolutely. We're just experiencing very gorgeous weather today. I'm in the Phoenix market, so it's lovely this time of the year.
Okay. We had a nice thunderstorm last night, so the air is clear and it's beautiful here as well.
Absolutely. Okay, let's talk about this. Book marketing mistakes to avoid. What do you see as maybe the number one or number two biggest mistakes that some of these people make when marketing their books?
Well, the easiest one is very simple, and that is they try to do too much. They spread themselves thin, and they don't do anything well. It's much better to focus on two or three things than try to do 20 things and not do them well.
And that's
a problem every marketer has, is that they spread themselves too thin. I'm as guilty of it as anybody.
Yeah, I think you're right. A lot of marketers, well, you know what, and here's what's so funny is, first of all, that mistake is made sometimes organically, right? I mean, you don't know what you're doing, so you're doing too many things. Then later on, you become an experienced, successful marketer, and then you think do more than one thing, which is, again, it's just wrong.
Yes. So you can know too much and know too little and still make the same mistake.
That's right. Well, you know what, and that's why it's important to have somebody there to help you. Let's talk about this. When marketing your books, what do you think is the most important elements?
That's real easy. To me, that's creating relationships. Looking for the professional relationships that will help you to sell your book. That means the right editors, the right bloggers, the correct websites, anybody that owns a good email newsletter, the newsletter publishers, the catalogs that service your market, the retailers that service your market, et cetera, et cetera. There's so many opportunities out there, but the key thing is to focus on the top 20 to 50 people that really could make a difference in your book. And that you have to identify. And if you don't know how to identify it, that's when you either hire somebody to help you identify it or you do some study.
Right. Or, I think that a great place to start is bookmarket.com, which is your website, bookmarket.com. There's
right.
not only just tons of resources there, but there's other people there that have marketed their books and sold books where you connect with some of these people and start building some of these relationships and maybe kind of get headed in the right direction.
Well, to me, it is always just surprising when authors don't choose to work with each other on marketing books because, you know, each of you have a piece of the audience. And if you combined all your audiences together, you know, especially if you had related books, and you started pitching each other's books to your audiences, you would double your exposure, in minutes.
Yeah, you know what, and I love that idea. Not only are you going to double your exposure, but you're going to reduce your costs, too.
Right.
Let me ask you about this. Here you are, your best-selling author, 1,001 Ways to... I just lost it. Is it 1,001 Ways to Sell Your Books or Sell More Books?
To market
your
books.
Market your books. Sorry about that. I lost it on my teleprompter. It went away.
Well, that's okay, Ernie.
Oh, man. All right. Yeah, now we're getting serious here. All right. Well, let me ask you this. Carry your book. And then you built this entire platform around your book, 1,000 Ways to Market Your Books.
Right.
Was that your goal from the very beginning?
No, I was just going to publish some books that I was working on, but I found that the information wasn't there, so I started creating the information. I had a background in marketing in the gift and toy industry, so I knew something about that. So I started by doing a directory of book printers because I needed the information. And, nowadays you can do it on the Internet, but back then you couldn't. So, you know, I started with that directory, and then everybody said, well, I've got the books. Now what do I do with them? And I said, well, I know at least 101 ways you can market your books. And so the first edition was called 101 Ways. But then people said I lied, so then I called it 1001 ways. But I've never counted them.
Oh, that's funny. Okay, good. So there may be more or less in there, depending on
I don't know who's going to be obsessive enough to find out, you know.
All right, well, okay, so let me ask you this. If somebody was going to write a book today, let's say a nonfiction book, would you tell them, would you advise them that they should start thinking about, you know, using their book as the, like a business card as the beginning of the sales and relationship versus the end?
I think it should be somewhere in the middle. I think you should start building the relationships as you write the book. And, you know, so many people come to me and they've spent 2 or 3 years writing a book and they say, now what do I do? And I say, well, what relationships do you have? What's your platform? And they're going, what? It's like they haven't thought that all along that when they were writing that they could have been building a platform at the same time. Tweeting and Facebooking and Google sharing and making some videos and sharing the discoveries that they've made along the way, all those things would build up the anticipation and build up the expectation. I mean, there was one guy that podcast his book as he was writing it, and he built up a listenership of 80,000 people. And so when his book came out, he had an automatic right there. People eager to buy the book, even though he had podcast the entire thing, the people wanted the wholeness of it.
Sure, sure.
And that's the thing,
you know,
that people, you know, writers can get hooked up on, and even business people, is that they're afraid they're giving away too much. And in my experience, you can't give away too much because people are always hungry. They want one more piece of information from you, and most people will pay and buy an entire book to get that one more piece of information.
Absolutely. You know what? And I agree with what you're saying there. People are so concerned that, you know, that they're, as you said, giving away too much. I see this all the time with inexperienced book marketers. You know, they put together their book, and if you sign up on their website, they'll give you a free chapter of that book. Like, you know, I don't know if a free chapter of that book is going to be sexy enough to get people to sign up, but they're so concerned about giving it away that they forget that really their whole job is to build a relationship. So, as you mentioned earlier, build a relationship so people want more. Build a relationship so they anticipate the entire book. Or, you know, to use the your example of the guy who was podcasting the book and built a relationship. And, you know, guys, a great example to me about the fact that you can't give away too much of the information is, you know, Harry Potter, and I know this is a fictional book, but Harry Potter, the movies created more book sales, not less, right? And
right.
The same thing with, you know, the same thing with just about anything out there. You know, what do you call it? What's this guy's name? John Maxwell. He's got a few books out there. And, you know, he will give away a bunch of information at his seminars, and people will buy more books because they start to like John. They start to like him, and they want to know more about him and the same thing. And so that's what you know, that's the whole thing about building a relationship, right?
Right. And the thing is that the book should not be your end product. Your book is, as you said earlier, basically a big business card. It's what introduces you to thousands or even millions of people that then buy your speaking engagements or your consulting or your coaching or your additional information packages and so on and so forth. And it's those things, you know, very few authors get rich on one book. There are exceptions to that, but for the most part, the authors that do it make the money by doing other things. I mean, the major income for most children's book authors is not the book itself, but the opportunity to get paid to go speak in schools. And business authors, the same thing. It's the opportunity to go and speak to corporations and be, you know, the featured speaker at a convention and so on and so forth. Those are the things that pay off in a big, big way. and it's a way that you really build income. Even Chicken Soup for the Soul, while they sold millions and millions of copies, they still made a lot of money through their licensing of the logo and so on products, and they probably made as much money that way as they did through the books.
Absolutely. John, we're out of time. John Kramer, everybody, check him out at bookmarket.com, bookmarket.com. He'll help you sell more books. I guarantee it. He's got 1,001 ways to do it. John Kramer, thank you so much for stopping by and sharing.
Thanks, Bert, for inviting me back.
You bet. We'll talk to you later. Guys, we're done. We are out of here. As always, thank you so much for stopping by. We will talk to you later.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.